sounds like we're doing a really bad job at plot summary. There's just a lot of like things happening in this book. Like it's
the plot sounds insane when you absolutely explain it too.
And yeah, it
like,
is insane.
I could give you like a 1 minute nut of here's the plot of the book, and it'll sound insane.
Honestly, Kurt, you should do that. I want to hear you do it. If you want to go for a 1 minute nut of the, I think that would
sure.
be. Would be fun.
Sure. So it is. So Snow Crash is about the world's greatest hacker and sword fighter, and arguably the world's greatest skateboard courier, uncovering a global corporate conspiracy to install DRM, which was extracted from a linguistic virus from ancient Sumeria that arrived on Earth from space, to install intellectual DRM into the minds of the world's programmers so that you can't remember stuff that happens at work anymore. And it also involves immigration and a Pentecostal religious cult.
Yeah, it's insane. It's like, I always, whenever I try and like summarize something and I feel insane, I flash back to being in high school and trying to summarize the plot of Sound of Music to somebody. I know that's completely different. I was like, yeah, so it's like nice. And it's like this kind of a romance or whatever. And then the Nazis show up and they're like, well, what? You know, I love trying to do a 1 minute summary of something that like just is completely anything can sound insane when you say that. But to be clear, this book is kind of insane. And yeah, it's to talk a little bit about Snow Crash itself, the concept, because I told my friend today, hey, I think you'd like this book. He's like a big, he likes cyberpunk. He likes Mad Max, that kind of thing. He says, do they crash a lot in the snow? And I'm like, no, they actually never, there's no snow in the book as far as I remember.
Well, not as we understand it.
No, that's true. But like,
there is snow- very late when he goes up north towards Alaska.
Okay,
I believe that there is
go.
Snow there. Technically.
Okay. Fair enough. Snow Crash is referring to the phenomenon of when a computer goes down and do it like the system crashes sufficiently, it creates enough like static on screen to be like snowy. I think that's more of a thing with older computers.
My English teacher used to call it the bug races. Yeah.
The bug races. Well, just static, so, basically.
Yeah, it's referring to, yeah, it's very, it's like triple outdated, but early CRT monitors have essentially an electron gun inside them that shoots electrons at the phosphor screen, and that's what makes it light up. And at a certain hardware level, there is like a part of the, not it's not the CPU, but part of the graphics processor, although later it would just be part of the monitor, that
right.
steered that electron gun to shoot the right pixels at the right spot. And so it's the idea that the computer crashes so completely that it literally loses the ability to control that little electron gun and just draws random shit mm-hmm. all over the screen, basically. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we don't have CRT monitors anymore, or much anymore. And even when we did, the electron gun, you know, since like the early or mid 80s was controlled by like an onboard thing within the monitor itself. It wasn't actually like mm-hmm. part of the computer anymore. But yeah, it's like double archaic computer yeah. technology.
We've moved on past critical race theory monitors. No, actually there is some CRT that needs to be discussed with this book, but we'll get into it in a second.
Yes.
One concept at a time.
It reads much more. It's a much more absorbing read than we're making it sound like. You know, structurally.
No, it's incredibly absorbing. Yeah.
Structurally, you know, it's noir. You know, it's drug runs. It's mysteries. You know, there's assassinations and stuff. You know, it eases you into the really esoteric concepts with very familiar storytelling beats.
To talk about the snow. Yeah, absolutely. There are these drug runs, and Snow Crash is a drug. Like Joss is saying, there are these drug runs. It is like a thing people snort and it gets into their head.
There's a digital version, a physical version.
Yes, the digital. And it's basically doing the same thing, which is basically predicated on the idea that somewhere deep in the brain, very, very deep in the brain, it cites all kinds of linguists that are like, it cites real studies. This isn't necessarily a real concept, but it's founded on something. That the idea of there is something that you could, if you knew the right words, you could unlock the programming of the brain, the ones and zeros of the brain. And that language is basically like a programming language that's less complicated, or like a system that allows you to move the blocks around. Instead of programming at the ones and zeros, you are doing things at a bigger level. And if you want, if you could know those words, you could manipulate it on a basic level. And basically the idea is like speaking in tongues, is that coming out? That idea of like that Babel, is that coming out? And the concept of the Tower of Babel in ancient Sumeria, as Kurt referenced, was basically people no longer having access to that basic like communication back and forth. And it was, it gets into a lot, and we don't have to get into all the details for the sake of like both ourselves and also like the listeners, but it gets into like spells that are basically like programming people's minds by talking at them, by being able to get into their heads, and the Snoke, and then that gets passed on both genetically, and it can be passed on through this static snow crash thing that people look at and they like absorb the information with their minds if they can read it. It's a lot, but it also like it comes down to the idea of this like programming being in the real world, the ones and zeros of the metaverse. There is also a programming language for the real world, and they used to call it magic. And then you can tie in the Bible and all kinds of cool mythological
stuff. Yes, a perfectly literal language that speaks to like the deep structures of your brain in a way that you know our more high context languages have completely forgotten, and was used to transmit concepts like baking bread and building houses.
Yes. Yeah, it's the exact concept of the three ring binder that you read earlier. It is, it is a parallel of that, because like there's a part of the book where Stevenson goes into this really interesting explanation about bread baking, basically this idea that culture is essentially the operating system that lives in the human mind. But it's harkening back to there's a linguistic development. It's a discredited theory called the bicameral mind, and the idea was that before a certain stage of human brain development, humans weren't really conscious the way that we are now. People didn't really self-reflect. They just kind of, they knew rules of behavior, as you said, like to bake bread, I follow these steps, and I do that every single time. I'm never even going to reflect on, is there a different way? This is how you bake bread. This is how I make bread. And it's like it's like a program that you execute. And there's and the idea of the bicameral mind is that before that era, independent thought was experienced as God talking to you, and that basically the origin of religion is humans attempting to have conscious thought, but not really being familiar with the concept and interpreting their own internal thoughts as God speaking to them. So like, instead of being like, I should go to the store today, I'm hungry, it was, lo, you must go to the store today, you know, like,
which actually unbelievable to me that John 1:1 doesn't get quoted in this book, but is. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. Which, like, there's no way he wasn't thinking about that when he, like, there's no way that he didn't come across that.
Yeah,
at some point.
I wonder if that's something that was, like, this is a little bit too on the nose.
That's fair enough. I mean, this, yeah, true. But it kept ringing in my head. I kept expecting, like, I don't know, L. Bob Reif to say it, like, in a dramatic monologue. You know what I mean?
Which, because for somebody who runs, like, a world, globe-spanning, like megachurch franchise, basically, right? You know, Reverend Wayne's Pearly Gates, right?
I love
it. One would think. Which notably has, like, Elvis as one of its,
I love, figures. I love the church franchise.
Oh, my God.
So
Neil Stevenson, Danny McBride. Crossover win, do the Righteous Gemstones thing. Yeah, no, that's and basically he's turned and you know, Juanita, who is not really a character who shows up a lot, but is basically to call her a love interest implies there's much of a romance. It's a fast fling of heroes who is incredibly intelligent, programmer, very wealthy, who's
notably
kind of figures this,
the uncanny valley.
Yeah, figures this stuff out way ahead of him. Basically, she is interested in religion for like these reasons, because she's like, there is a fundamental 10%, she says 90% of it is bullshit, there's a fundamental 10% truth to it, and that is a thing that she, in this world, this 10% truth, and that's what she's like fascinated by and obsessed with. And then in that same way, the church franchises and all that is seen as almost not almost, it's literally described as like following L. Bob Reif, who he describes as an antichrist. It's described as in its own way, hedonism. It's described as Asherah worship. It is basically the idea of like this extra stuff is almost like satanic against true religion. And this isn't Neal Stephenson. I don't want it to sound like Neal Stephenson is writing a Left Behind novel here. This isn't a book that's proselytizing you to become a Christian or something, but it is dealing with these religious concepts in this world in a very interesting and bizarre way.
Yeah. There's this interesting idea of basically ancient religious figures as the first hackers. And so like there's this really interesting idea that gets advanced of, okay, so if human culture used to be an operating system, what would happen, or is an operating system, what would happen if there's a virus that gets into the operating system and starts corrupting human culture? And that becomes the explanation for both the Tower of Babel, the thing that actually happened, which is that basically someone who was a priest who could speak the deep language of the human brain created both modern religion and languages as essentially human antivirus software so that people wouldn't just be walking around speaking human assembly language. And then also Jesus is a later hacker who used the idea of a new covenant to break out of what Stevenson, or I think it's Juanita who describes it as like the rigid law-based structures of rabbinical Judaism, which I have not remotely the amount of knowledge to know whether that is like offensive or right or wrong. That's just what the book, you know, lays out. So
yeah, and notably says that then the Acts 2 event of Pentecost, the Holy Spirit coming upon among the disciples in the second book of or second chapter of Acts, Juanita says, is the perversion of Christianity. She says Christianity lasted like 50 days because that's when the disciples all start speaking in tongues and like the Holy Spirit comes upon them, which, like, to be very clear, this book is incredibly blasphemous if you're a Christian. I mean, not like, you know, obviously it's like fiction, but like, it's just fun. It's just funny because it's an interesting like dynamic you walk, because he has this like interesting reverence for like certain religious concept. There's this interesting reverence for certain religious concepts and this also interesting like change up. It makes me think of when I was a kid, I was in church, a church that was not all that different than one of the churches described in this book, like 10% different. And I was in a production where a children's production where I played Jesus, but I was a super spy. And Jesus has an earpiece, and I did a barrel roll, and I said I was on a secret mission for God. And I think Neal Stephenson might have like traveled forward in time and saw that. I don't know. I thought of that, and I was like, man, in hindsight, like, talk about blasphemy, but Jesus. But
you only live twice indeed.
Oh, yeah. But anyway, it took me a second. Anyway, I couldn't help but think of that while I was doing it. But it is weird how like that all this like religious stuff, and it's not just biblical. Like it's ancient like Sumerian religion and stuff like that gets tied in too.
It's interesting to me how okay, I'm gonna say primitive religion. I don't think that idea is not a good idea. That is like a fucked up like racist fucked up idea, but I'll say that there is a viewpoint that Snow Crash shares, I think, with early William Gibson to a degree, where data systems, be they human culture or a literal computer, become almost a spiritual realm where the unreal becomes real, because in I think it's in Count Zero, it's revealed that there's basically these like wild intelligences that have appeared in the internet that are experienced by computer users as loas, as basically like voodoo spirits.
Yes.
And this book is kind of is doing something similar with the idea of like the Asherah cult, the ancient Sumerian religion. I think they're both kind of getting at this idea of like this idea of primitive religion as being somehow more like passionate, but also more human. And that kind of like re-arising and almost like a golden bow type yeah. way of like it endlessly recapitulates, like, well, we had religion in the real world, therefore there must be internet religion too, like there must mm-hmm. also be biological religion, like it extends up and down into and out of infinity and never yes. ends. It's just like it's a recurrent facet of deep human nature almost.
Well, and that's part of what secures Juanita's place in the pantheon of, you know, the metaverse of the internet as it's understood here, because she, you know, you can have, it's that paradox of you can have infinite expression. You can be, you know, this ultimate warrior, you can be this monster, you can be this giant penis if your avatar, you know, if you want your avatar to look like that. But ultimately what the metaverse initially is missing is, as I said, you know, it's got that uncanny valley to overcome, right? And that's what Juanita solves, right? It's Juanita's faces that really set the metaverse apart from any other sort of internet space. And it's that understanding that she has of something primal, something unspoken and reflexive in the way that we communicate that leads her to start to uncover the central mystery of this novel.
Mm-hmm. Or, as I said in my notes, ghosts in the algorithm, ?
Yeah.
Adam and Eve, ? Infopocalypse, ? And then nothing else about that chapter. I didn't, I was like, you could see me struggling at that point. it is interesting. And it's like, he also like cites a bunch of like beliefs, like deeply felt beliefs as like examples of religions or mind viruses or whatever. Touche, he's got to cite Marxism as one of them.
well, and indeed, you know, Juanita herself draws the comparison. Like when Hero asks, okay, so is Snow Crash like a virus? Is it a drug? Is it a religion? Juanita says, what's the difference? Which, you know,
really makes you think, huh?
Well,
that's terrible.
I mean, in isolation, it's a very like, you know, why do you park on a driveway versus driving a parkway sort of question. But there is a thematic underpinning to it here.
Yeah, it works in context. No, 100%. Yes. Just to like bring it back around to like plot a little bit. We haven't talked about it much.
we haven't talked about anything that happened.
Oh, yeah.
There's a guy with a nuclear bomb and a motorcycle sidecar.
The guy who indeed introduces us to Snow Crash. This guy, this Aleutian guy.
Raven.
This Alaskan native, this Aleutian guy named Raven, who, as Kurt says, you know, he goes around with a hydrogen bomb as kind of a failsafe. If anybody kills him, if his heart stops, then the bomb goes off, right? And
Raven is a Jacob certified I could fix him character.
oh yes.
Sorry, go on, Joss.
He's got this avatar in the metaverse as well, of course, and it's through this avatar that he offers Hero, hey, do you want to try this Snow Crash? And Hero is, you know, enough of a he's a knowledgeable enough hacker to be like, okay, this is probably like buttfuck my computer.com, right? Mm. I'm not going to click on this. David, his former colleague, his former professional,
fired him over beer.
His former boss, yes, and current owner of the Black Sun Club in the metaverse where all the elite hackers hang out. David's like, oh, you know, like, what's possibly due to me? And of course, he looks at the Snow Crash and ends up not only crashing out of the club and like being ejected by the demons, the programs that keep it running, but brain damaged IRL.
Mm-hmm. And the idea is like Snow Crash, the program could do that to programmers, like we were saying, and the technological priesthood, which uses that term, and then the more literal like language based curse or spell or what have you, the programming of the mind can be done verbally, and also you can become made more susceptible to it through the drug, which basically inculcates you with the Asherah mind virus.
Yes, yes, because binary
is mind
also
virus.
The woke mind virus. How did I not think of that? Holy shit. The woke mind. If you think about it, wokeness is a religion. Has anyone heard of that? Anyone thought about this? Yeah.
I think the literary luminary Ben Shapiro interrogates it in his class. No.
It's very deep. Yeah. But yeah, and so basically, like, that's, I mean, like, the plot is him just investigating these concepts. He spends a lot of time just like kind of digging through the library, investigating these concepts while YT zips around and just like goes to fun little places and says, and like Neal Stephenson's like, here's another thing I have. Oh, here's a guy who lost all his limbs in Vietnam and now he drives a tank with his mind. Oh, here's a robot that used to belong to, or here's a dog that used to belong to YT that got kidnapped and turned into a robot. And it's like kind of sad, but also he exists in a world where everything is stakes in his mind. And then he's like gonna save her, and it's like, holy shit.
He's in the
And
dog matrix,
he's
Russ.
in the dog matrix. So true. Like,
So like mobile, truck slash scooter slash like, you know, sensory, like, you know, fulfillment tank, whatever, dude, Aang has a really interesting commentary on the fate of that particular dog, right? It's like, well, you know, it's a better existence than he could ever have dreamed of, because his constant his sensual his sensory needs are constantly fulfilled, and he has a job that gives him fulfillment in this sense. You know, he's just, you know, he
He
just equipped
basically
with better
gives him
means for a tool.
the Tyler Durden, you know, you will wear clothes that will last you your whole life speech, but it's about a dog.
Yes. Or yeah, and this is a guy who sees the spiel from the Matrix, you know, where he says, ignorance is bliss, I eat the steak, it tastes good, you know, I
Yeah,
don't
he
want to
goes,
know
yeah,
shit.
damn straight.
Yeah, and he's like, and as a guy who like life fucked him over, as a guy who has no limbs because of war, that and is able to go into the metaverse and have, you know, a life of some kind, it makes sense that you could like make that call. And he makes it for the dog, but it is notable, and this is like a moment of, I don't know if it's overcoming the metaverse, but towards the end, that dog Fido is just the dog's name, not original, but that's it's cute that she's like, oh, it's Fido, you know. He realizes that she's the girl who saved him, and he overcomes the programming, he overcomes all of it, and just he saves her and sacrifices his life to save her with these super dog powers that he has. And it's a badass scene, described him running like fire behind him, and he jumps like 1,000 feet and blows up a plane. Like, it's sick, but it's also like he does overcome those bounds of programming. The dog does, and there is like a real, I'm not gonna say human connection because it's a dog to human connection, but there is a real connection that actually does transcend that fake world, that to call it even a fake world feels wrong in the context of this book, because I don't think this book would call it fake exactly, but the virtual world.
Imagine those like Boston Dynamics dog robots, but like moving faster
And
than the speed of than the eye can see.
a real dog brain inside of it,
Well,
yes.
critically, the whole reason that happens is because YT sees she kind of has like the beneficial naivete of someone who hasn't bought into the bullshit yet, because for instance, everyone else sees, I think they're just called I think they're called rat things,
Yeah,
the
I think
dogs.
she might just call them that. I'm not sure. But they go that she
I
calls them
think
that at
everyone
least.
calls them that, and
Okay.
nobody really knows what they are. And because they move incredibly fast, and they live inside these little like hutches
Right.
that they only come out very briefly. You don't see them. They're basically like the private security force of Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong. And there's a
Yeah.
part where somebody throws a grenade at
That's right.
YT,
Well,
and a
yes.
dog.
Hero's getting chased. Yeah.
Yes. And a rat thing comes out, grabs it, and like tries to dispose of the weapon. It blows up and injures the rat thing. And YT is the only person who's like, oh, like, oh my gosh, like this thing is alive. And she goes out of her way and puts herself at risk to bring the robot dog back into its like little hutch so that it can be repaired. And that's the only reason that Fido finds her at the end, is that the other rat things are like talking to each other on basically like dog Facebook, and are like, oh, there was this girl who helped me when I got blown up, you know, in the outside place. I think that this is neat. There's like a neat little section like from the dog's point of view, and I think they just call the outside the hot place because they have like a thermal isotope generator inside them. And so every second that they're outside of their hutch, they're getting hotter and hotter and hotter and like basically about to melt down. And so like even going outside is very dangerous. And so like the thing that ultimately resolves the book, and I think this is very intentional, is that she recognizes the, you know, I say human, but it's a dog, but like, you know, she empathizes with the machine of something that is, you know, half alive, half machine, and just sees it as alive and still has compassion for it. Whereas all the other characters just see technology as like a tool, as a means to an end, as a weapon. Mm-hmm. It's nobody else understands it as like, wait, no, like there's people, there's living things here that we can connect with.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I just there's one concept that we haven't really gotten into that I wanted to mention for sure. And that is a place that sort of the final act of the book takes place on, and that's the raft.
Yes.
I know that's a hard pivot, but it's an interesting concept. The idea is, I maybe mentioned it briefly earlier, but L. Bob Reif, our sort of antagonist, you know, guy, has this thing where he takes a nuclear aircraft carrier,
the former USS Enterprise, yes,
that's right, and basically boats and rafts and junk and anything can strap themselves to it, and things can strap themselves to that or whatever, and in a very slow several year cycle he'll just take them around the Pacific Ocean, and he will, and basically people can go on refugees can go places. And he takes people from just all over, you know, the former Soviet Union, which is in like, you know, obviously it's in a bad place, and, you know, people from various Asian countries and all over the place. I mean, like, it's like over 1 million people are on this raft, and at this like place of like, it's like this lawless sort of place, at least in theory. People make movies about it or whatever. And it's a very interesting dynamic. It's a very cinematic concept of this gigantic like raft around this big metal thing. And of course, he's using it to deliver this big payload of like viral infection, basically, of like mind virus.
But in the form, critically, of immigrants.
Yes,
critically.
I was going to say that. I mean, if you listen to our last episode, like, this isn't True Allegiance straight up like, the immigrants are like, we hate all immigrants kind of thing, but it is a weird thing that you are introducing this disease and this like multi-billionaire information guy and all this stuff in this, his act of philanthropy is tied to the scheme of domination. And it is the unleashing of literally the unwashed masses on the Californian coastline.
So I have two touch points, one of which I think is accidental, and one of which I think is the real root of it. There's a French book called The Camp of the Saints, which is a famous.
Oh my God, I was just thinking about that.
Anti-immigrant. Yeah, this didn't occur until years later, and when like somebody mentioned
that,
like,
Jean Raspail.
Yeah, Jean Raspail. Yes, yeah. I compared True Allegiance to that book. Yeah.
Okay.
This book has literally the plot of it, and in the raft, where The Camp of the Saints, the idea is basically like, there is this kind of like conspiracy to overwhelm Europe with immigration and like the unwashed immigrant masses, and I forget where it comes from, but there's like a military force that starts picking up all these immigrants, and they're going to like invade Europe with all the, you know, the dirty theocratic Muslims and blah blah blah, you know, it's very famously racist book. I don't think that that's what Stevenson is going for, but I think it is telling that he basically winds up with the same concept, which is this idea of immigration as an infection vector. But what I think the real, I think a big part of where this is coming from and why it feels so like weird nowadays compared to the rest of the book is in the 90s, we have to remember that Stevenson is a tech guy.
Yeah.
And in the 90s, if you were a well-paid computer guy, your enemy was not the company. The company was kind of like a neutral force. You would complain about them, much as, you know, they were stupid and inefficient. Think like Dilbert with like the pointy-haired boss.
Yes.
but your real enemy was outsourcing. It was offshoring. And I think that that's what Stevenson... I think that Stevenson gets a bit reactionary here because he sees... he sees a third world, and he sees that as a threat with you know, unintelligent, shoddy programmers and shoddy technology that's fucking up his, you know, his perfect, you know, technocratic world. And again, mm-hmm. I don't think he's like doing this to make an anti-immigrant commentary, but that sentiment was all over the place. And you still hear it. You still hear people say, you know, oh, this is probably what's the stereotype of when you call customer service? Oh, it's, you know, it's an some Indian person, guy. Yeah. It's some, some Malaysian guy. That's a very 90s sentiment. And it was everywhere. And I won't say that it was unquestioned. It was unquestioned by people like Stevenson to a large point.
It's also worth noting, and we discussed this some with our Left Behind episode, which is 1995, but there is this concept of like Japan as a rising like terror that time.
Oh,
This concept of like, I mean, Joss, you said that you remember there being a book from the 90s. It's like The Coming War with Japan, right?
Yes, my father had it lying around. It was written in like 1991, and it was, The Coming War with Japan. And it was all the like economic scaremongering that we say today about China, right? That, you know, our interest in the Pacific will necessarily come into conflict with their interests. And, you know, I mean, you know, the Japan thing was ultimately averted by our conspiracy to crash the yen, which we can't do with China. But you know, it's that same basic principle.
Notably, though, like in this book, what's the only really the only great power in this book is Japan. Like that's the only country that seems to be holding it together in any
China
capacity.
Is weirdly absent from this book. Like
it's got very Hong Kong. Like it talks about Kong bucks because the US dollar isn't worth shit.
There's Hong Kong, and there's a disclaimer that like, oh, you know, like the entity of Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong is not affiliated with like the city with like China itself. There's a mention of Red China as like an entity unto itself.
And there's a part where it says you're not allowed to be a communist to come into the US government place, and YT says, what's that? So like there's like maybe there's still communism, like there's a still like a China or I don't know. It's not really the point, but it is interesting that Japan, in which he refers to as Nippon through the book, which is just another term for Japan, term people use there, is this great power. So you have that as like a threat, you know, militarily, economically, as a cogent force, and then you have the I'm not saying this, but the concept of the unwashed masses coming over as the other force.
And they really are portrayed as either idiots or criminal rapists.
Yes, with a few exceptions. There is a part where he like saves a guy, a Filipino guy, and then he's got like a family who just want to come for a better life.
That's also like the only... It intersects
segment.
With like the only gay characters in the book as well. Like they're literally like rapist pirates.
Oh, well, it says they're not home. It says actually, well, they're not homosexuals. They're just out on the ocean.
They're just pirates.
out at sea, it goes. And, you know, there's any rules, which is like it's kind of funny, but also you are right. It is the only gay characters, and it's like it could be
just by default.
Know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like, it's, which is weird because like there's in the sense of this book being anti-racist anywhere, there is one, I mean, you know, there's obviously like, we're not supposed to see the overt racism of the New South Africans as good, right? You know, they're portrayed as, you know, backwards and hicks. And
whatnot. We have like a scene of them getting like chopped to bits. And it's
and
like,
there's
fun.
Also like the, I mean, my favorite scene of the book is when Hiro is in the Black Sun Club. And this Nipponese businessman comes up to him, Nipponese being Japanese in this book, and he's like, oh, you know, you have those really awesome swords, and yet you're a black man, you know, how do you come by that? And Hiro proceeds to demolish him in a sword fight, right?
Yeah, and before he gets burned by the fire, digital fire, he sees a ranking list of the greatest sword fighters in the world. Which I really wanted, I was really disappointed that when that doesn't happen, like there's not a moment where Raven got decapitated and he saw himself listed second to Hiro. I thought that would have been so funny.
even
though it's
incredible.
Bullshit, because obviously Raven could kick Hiro's ass, but like if he had beaten him in the metaverse, it's just a funny idea. It doesn't matter. It's not important, but I thought that was coming and it didn't.
But yeah,
funny gag though.
In the sense of it being anti-racist, you know, it is that very, it is in the sense of like personal behavior rather than anything structural, right? Rather than anything like institutional in nature. But which it kind of problematizes the people that you know, the dynamic of Rife picking up the people on the raft and, you know, bringing them around. Like, the charitable reading of it, I think, is, okay, like, if you outsource and you basically reduce people to a particular function that doesn't necessarily require any sort of skill or knowledge, you know, just reduce people to basically cogs, right? You know, you run the risk of somebody figuring out how to manipulate them and then, like, turn them back on you, right? But, and, you know, the imagery is unmistakable, Kurt. You're correct.
And one could also make the point that, like, oh, it's also bad that people have set up machine guns and barbed wire on the beach waiting for these people. And
oh, yeah.
And I think the Neal Stephenson would be like, yeah, it's all bad, which is like a lot of this book. It's like
it's very Clinton era where it's like, mm-hmm. where it's like, we yes. don't want, it's like, we don't like immigrants. But you right. gotta be nice to them, you know. Not let them in the country. Here, yeah. No, not like definitely not that. But you know, like you know, you feel bad. You feel bad. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But at the same time, the scene that really hit me this time is when YT gets arrested mm-hmm. by I forget what they're called. They're
it's one of the really, private security forces. Yeah,
yeah they're like hyper super mall cops where they have so much. Like gadgets and bullshit that like they basically can't move and like
yeah.
they don't even like to get out of their car. And so they apprehend YT by just shooting like what's called like a snot gun at her, which
yeah,
is just like a big
gun, yeah.
like sticky like filament glue thing that just kind of like sticks her to a car, I think.
Yeah.
But they bring her to she gets a choice between the Clink and the Hooskow. And I think the Hooskow is like an upscale jail where if she could pay an upgrade fee, the cops will take her to a nice, to like a nicer hotel.
And it's Western themed.
Hotel yeah, jail. Like, that's right. That's yeah. right. Yes. And they serve like cowboy chili and stuff like that. It's so a jail. So she pays for it, but then the Hooskow is filled. So they take her to the Clink, which basically just seems to be like the basement of a 7-Eleven.
Just handcuffed to a radiator or something?
Yes. Yes. She gets handcuffed to a radiator and she's literally calling like I think they're supposed to be like, they're from Tajikistan. And mm-hmm. she literally calls them Jeeks.
Yes.
And I'm like, oh, Jesus, man. Come yeah. on. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't just make up a new slur and then yeah. just start using it and be like, but it's fine because it's not a real slur. It's like, yeah, but now you made it up. Now it is real.
Yeah, new slur just dropped. Yeah. No. Yeah, absolutely. There are like 100%. There are like moments like that that are. And you know, I don't know what to say about it aside from to acknowledge that it's there.
It's the Apu Simpson thing where it was just fine to be racist towards yeah. mm-hmm. you know working class people of color who were from like East Asia. It was just fine to be mm-hmm. racist, you know, towards them
right.
openly.
Like basically. There's a clear demarcation between the racism, like the like New South African racism and that type of racism,
right.
like in this book. It's interesting and it's definitely just like reflective of the culture. If we're gonna while I'm thinking about elements of the book that are like kind of uncomfortable, there is like some weird stuff with YT for
the
sure.
sex stuff.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And I don't know what to make of it exactly because it is acknowledged. 15-year-old, she's 15 years old. 15-year-old girls do get sexually harassed and taken advantage of, and like mm-hmm. it's not inherently predatory to acknowledge that, but there is like sometimes it does feel a little more than it needs to be. I don't know if y'all felt that way or not. I wasn't quite
definitely.
Sure.
Well, because in particular, like she hooks up with Raven toward the end, right?
That part, yeah. Which is a weird dynamic because it's not like she's completely in control of the situation, but it's I don't think portrayed with like it's a sexual assault, you know?
No. I think it's very much supposed to be consensual.
Yeah, I agree.
But again,
but she's 15 and she is
15.
I don't know, mid-20s at the earliest.
Yeah,
at the youngest.
It's I think that the act as it's not so much how it's depicted in the book. It's the role that it plays in the book, which is it really does. It feels like a punchline, and it is a pretty good punchline where
yeah.
basically she forgets to remove this. There's something called a dentata, which has been referred to obliquely throughout the book. And what it
yeah.
turns out to be is basically like a vaginal insert that has a hypodermic needle loaded with the very powerful sedative.
Yeah,
so
that is
like,
funny. Yes.
Yeah. And so like the punchline is like she forgets to remove it. And so, you know,
it knocks his ass out. Yeah.
Raven
very,
just gets like
well
knocked
executed,
out
because like I'm reading it at the time that the sex scene's playing out, and I'm like, wait a minute, like we're forgetting something here, and it's like, oh, like it's just like a subtle needle, like you know, you don't even notice it as it's happening, right? So yeah, it's
yeah.
But like one can't forget that, and I know Raven's the villain and all that, and she's immature, but like she's 15, and it feels weird. I don't really know what else to say.
Feels the way that it's written, I think, is partly salacious, and I would compare it. I would compare it to, you ever watch like, I don't know if you guys are like anime people at all, but like if you ever watch like late 80s, early 90s anime, there's just a lot of sexual assault in it. There's a lot of sexual assault, and it's just, and it's put in there to titillate.
And the girl's got like a hammer that she pulls out of nowhere. Like,
oh, I was going to talk about like in like Ninja Scroll, for instance, there's just straight up, there's just like sexual violence, and it's used as titillation for an adolescent male like audience. It's not used to be like a nuanced depiction of sexual assault, nor
that shit's still around.
Yeah, it's still around. It's used to be a lot more open and worse, I will say. And I think that what feels gross about it is that like YT is also, you know, sexualized. Like the book sexualizes her multiple times, not like to a huge extent, but there
happens, a bit
of like, ooh, you know, she's getting naked, you know, and it's like she is 15, so.
Yeah,
I think that I don't think there's anything especially deep to it apart from it's gross and it's sexist, you know, and I think it's fine to say that. I don't think it's intended as anything more than that. And
like, I don't think it's Stevenson saying like, I don't think it's Stevenson saying, oh, I think it's good for an adult to have a relationship with a 15-year-old. No, on the other hand, it's done in a way that is. Not,
it's still in the book, and it's like, let's talk about how sexy she is, kind of. It's not quite that bad, but
it
is,
it shouldn't,
you know.
It's not done right. It's sexist.
It tries to have its cake and eat it too, because Hero is specifically called out as being virtuous, because like YT specifically says, like, he doesn't seem like the sort of older guy who would want to fuck a 15-year-old. And she says it kind of wistfully, like, oh, you know, like, he's kind of nice looking, but he doesn't seem like a sleazeball. And I think Hero at one point mentions, like, she's like a teenager. So it's both in the text of characters being like, I'm virtuous, I don't sleep with teenagers, but the book is a little bit horny about it too, and so it's
It's there are shades of Leo Frankowski here and there, like in the, I mean, we'll talk about him eventually, but
and I mean, like, I was reading people's commentary online about certain things, and like, and I saw somebody say, like, the classic, like, well, it was the 90s, it was a different time. It's like, okay, but it was still bad. Like, it's not, doesn't make it okay, you know? And like, we can acknowledge that was wrong.
Yeah, I mean,
also say
it was a book written by a dude for an audience assumed primarily to be dudes. Like, probably not overtly. Yeah, exactly. Like, it's, you know, it is, to, you know, to misuse a badly misused term, it is very much male gaze, you know, it's there to titillate a bit. And I think it's fine to acknowledge that and be like, well, that's pretty not good.
Yes. I'm trying to come up with like a male gaze, G-A-Y-S pun right now. as a member of the male gaze, it wasn't written for me, but I still enjoyed a lot of it. But that, not those parts specifically.
So essentially, like, the CIA in this timeline has merged with the Library of Congress, right? So it's more of an information broker, like, basically a paid Wikipedia, than an intelligence community as we know it, right? So you can, that's what Hero does for his, like, quote unquote real job, right? Is he finds intel and he sells it to the CIC, the Central Intelligence Community, and he, you know, sits pretty on the income from that based on how cool what he's delivered to them is. And Kurt, as you have in mind to say, it's given rise to a subculture of people called gargoyles, basically, who have devoted their whole lives to collecting all this noise and sifting
streamers.
Some kind of signal. Yes, exactly. Yes. They got a GoPro everywhere.
Yeah. And, well, I really like how they're introduced, which is, I forget the guy's name, the gargoyle. There's this guy who is basically a researcher.
Lagos,
thank you. Yes, thank you. He's a researcher who we're kind of meant to understand is, he has I don't know if this comparison will make sense, but he's kind of the way that computer programmers in the mid-90s looked at model train enthusiasts, where it's like they were kind of like a cousin group, but not cool. And we don't really want to be associated with them, even though we kind of share the same lineage. So Lagos is like a very uncool gargoyle, who's someone who wears all this like scanning and capture and recording gear. And he just kind of travels around trying to record interesting things, but he's been doing research on Snow Crash, and he's the one who puts Hero on the trail. And he's also he also gets fucking sliced up by Raven.
Yeah, Raven takes him out,
guts him. And there's a really it's called back to later, where Hero gargoyles up himself and like is like super embarrassed to be wearing all this like external wearable computer bullshit,
and like YT and roasts him for it.
Everyone's making fun of him for it. And there's a really great quote that's something like, Hero turned off all the techno goggle shit, all he was doing was watching statistics about his death in real time. Very postmodern.
I love it. And Lagos is like this important figure, not as like a character because he's not around for very long, but he did compile all that information, which is like very useful. And it also, which it like allows, which is like, that's also the first time Raven shows up in the book. Like, or well, no, the first, no, that's not true. The first time he shows up is when he's in the metaverse.
Snow Crash, yeah.
Giving Snow Crash, but the first time you see him in person is when he rolls up, you know, this big guy with the long, like the dark hair, and he uses glass knives and spears and harpoons.
And the first thing, that Lagos says is, "That's Raven. Don't fuck with him."
And Hero's like,
and Hero is like, "I think I can handle myself." And he's like, "No. You see that sidecar? That's a nuclear bomb. Do not fuck with him."
Literally, yeah. Which, and this is only literally just now occurred to me, but it's so. I mean, Lagos, right? His big weakness is that he compiles all this information. He synthesizes it, but he doesn't necessarily, you know, when the time comes, you know, who's stronger than him? The guy with the glass knives and the nuclear bomb, right? He doesn't have the sort of real world capacity to put this theory he's assembling into practice. Hero does, right?
No, yeah, he looked Raven in the eyes and said, "In the gaming world, you're the loser." And then Raven stabbed him, basically. Like, like there is still real materiality that, like, the metaverse is not completely king. And Raven is like, his motivation is basically his father, and turns out Hero's father were in the same detention camp during World War II.
I forgot about that shit.
Yes.
Yeah. It's yeah.
The real why so much Martha.
There's so much in this book. Yes.
At the end, like when they're in a like
Batman versus Superman was good. Yeah.
They got like a.
It was good. It was good.
In the metaverse. I still have not seen that movie.
That's a whole different conversation, but but yeah, no, it's interesting because he's a Pacific Islander, right? He's Alouette, and he's basically, his father was in this Japanese internment camp, and so was his not Japanese internment camp, but a internment camp in Japan, like as a prisoner of war. And basically he and Hero's father escaped. And while the escape was happening, the bombing of Nagasaki happened, which basically covered for their escape. And, that's like where Hero's dad got his katana. So it's like the origin story of that.
Right.
But it's also like, and then later on, Raven's father will be nuked again by the American government testing bombs on Pacific Islands, which he makes the note. He says, "You say the only people who have ever been nuked are the Japanese. That's not true. The Pacific Islanders have been nuked. Indigenous people have been nuked all over the world," which is
all true. Completely true. But by the way, that aspect is, that's just history.
No, that's legitimately true. It's
there's horrific birth defects. Like, cancer rates are very high in the places where these nuclear tests were conducted. Like, it's awful.
People died. Yeah, no, it's horrible. Awful.
And there were indeed nuclear tests in the Aleutian Islands also. That is a real thing.
And as a result, he has this understandable resentment towards the United States, and he says he wants to nuke the United States. Yes,
I love that. You gave us a nuclear bomb, so I just want to give one back to you.
Now, what I don't quite understand is why Raven doesn't just use his nuclear bomb.
Yeah, that is, I was thinking about that earlier, and it never occurred to me until today. But you have a good point. I don't know. Yeah,
and maybe he's waiting for the right moment. I know he's working with these Russian Christian group that's affiliated with Elbab Reif, which is why he's kind of like in his employment. Not kind of. He's in his employment through proxy.
The ultra orthodox. Yeah.
Yeah, but. Well, yeah, sorry, go ahead, Kurt.
I was going to say, I mean, I think we're supposed to understand that, like, he wants to do that, but he also is kind of just, like, having a good time. Like,
he seems to enjoy himself.
A badass motherfucker. He's like a cool biker guy, and he literally has poor impulse control tattooed on his forehead.
I'd say again, I could fix him.
Yeah. In fact, I think it's explained that he used to be, like, an oil rig worker, and, like, if you do, like, you know, if you get in like enough crimes on an oil rig in this world, they just tattoo your crime on your forehead as a warning to other
people. Comes across a guy that just says violent and racist on his head. And he's just looking at Hero. And then Hero's like, oh, shit.
Well, the thing of it is, part of it, dying. Part of what Raven's doing here, you know, because he falls in with Elbab Reif because he's in with that kind of ultra-Orthodox group that's providing security for the Raft, A. But also, to return to the president here and the peripheral role that the feds play in this, the U.S. government is kind of helping Elbab Reif build out the infrastructure for
basically,
this.
They're getting contracted by the people they used to contract is like kind of what's happening. It's like, what if the U.S. government basically was just cash starved and was like, okay, we'll just do coding for Amazon.
Right. And it's that infrastructure that Raven is angling to ultimately destroy, right? Because there's, as we said, there's a big motorcycle chase between him and Hero in the metaverse at like 60,000 miles an hour, where Raven's going to that like center point, which is the stadium where all the like, you know, bigwigs are of the internet world. And there's where he's going to, you know, fry everybody's brain.
I have to say I'm in favor of nuking Fortnite, which is the modern equivalent of
fair
this.
Enough.
But I think that's why Raven. I think there's a part where Raven says something to the effect of, like, at first I just wanted to like blow up this nuke in the US, but then like it was conveyed to me that it would be better and even more damaging if I nuked their minds, I think.
Yes.
Like I think he says that at one point. And so his goal is to deliver the Snow Crash virus and kill all the programmers, basically.
Right.
You know,
yes. for technological priesthood. Yeah. It's interesting. There is a article recently, and this is a step back from the Washington Post that really went into the nature of the regulation state, and like how when you contract out subcontractors, they can kind of become part of the regulation state. All that to say, it basically noted that large parts of the regulation state are now just directly controlled by Elon Musk, which is, I mean, seems fine, right? Obvious sarcasm there, but like, and so Joss, you were talking about like that idea of like that integration, and I just came to mind. I know that that's a side tangent, but talking about the integration with the government, I had to think of that,
and how the whims of one guy essentially and the capital that he controls can dictate the regulatory environment. It's regulatory capture.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's also it's also just like privatization, which is like a, like a big theme, to the point that it's explained to us that there are two rival companies that own all the highways in the U.S. and they literally have like sniper battles with each other over contested intersections, like where their roads cross.
Oh, yes. And like the armed forces of the United States as well. You know, like, you know, there's General Bob, there's Admiral Jim, you know.
That's right. I forgot to say that.
There's like three different police forces that have like varying degrees of brutality.
Yeah, and notably, when the final confrontation comes, the U.S. government is present as a very junior partner, in the Elbab Reif side of the coalition, because the climax of this book happens as the Raft is coming in off the West Coast, and on one side you have Elbab Reif, you know, with his secret weapon basically being Snow Crash, and he's got Raven as his enforcer guy, and Raven's doing his badass thing where he's going up against people with guns by going around on a canoe throwing spears, and that's that one side. The U.S. government is backing them, and it's like all the money and all that. And on the other side, you have Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong and, you know, the protagonists of our book, including hero protagonists and the mafia.
Yes, Uncle Enzo. Enzo fights Raven is so fucking cool.
Oh, it goes so hard. No, Uncle Enzo is just, talk about Uncle Enzo. Go for it.
He is a Vietnam veteran. And he went to war to piss off his father. And he came out of it, a really seasoned fighter. But that's actually a source of, this is going back, but like very early in the novel, right? Enzo meets YT and he's like, hey, thank you for completing the delivery that Hero wasn't able to. Here's my dog tags from Vietnam. Show them to someone when you're in trouble and you'll get out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's he himself that ends up fighting Raven in the real world, to a draw, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it is implied that maybe he survives. Maybe he's mortally wounded. Lives. Yeah. So Uncle Enzo he's the real deal. As mm-hmm. it turns out, like that's one of those things where it's an open question, because when YT gets the dog tags, at first she's very overawed by it. And then immediately after she's like, this is probably just like a fucking prop that he gave me. Like he probably gives everyone, you know, oh, here's my dog tags. I want you to have this. But she does wear them anyway. And later on, she meets him again, as I recall. And he kind of. I think he claims that they really were his.
There's a guy, the guys who's doing security scans him, and he's like, tell me how good your security is. And he's like, I'm scanning you. You have this much money in your pocket. You're not wearing the dog tags you always had. You whatever. It's like on the list. And it's like, right. Yeah, they were his dog tags. He's legit.
And but what's funny is that like Uncle Enzo is also putting on a face, and he kind of mm-hmm. acknowledges that, like, I think at one point he says something like, normally I give people flowers, but I guess you don't really care about that. And he kind of acknowledges like YT is sort of above all this bullshit, but Enzo is portrayed as like a real deal guy sitting atop this kind of corporatized bullshit bureaucracy that kind of has, it's kind of like the mafia plus like sales guys, because there's this long sequence with like a really stupid low-level mafia guy who thinks he's doing he thinks that he's been called up to the big leagues, but actually he was just supposed to give the package to YT because Uncle Enzo wanted to meet YT. And then at the end, Uncle Enzo uses his fucking straight razor to fight Raven and his spears and his glass knives. And it's literally like, it's this old Vietnam vet who talks about, you know, like not wanting to wear a helmet so that you can hear better. And he's just got a fucking straight razor against a dude with a nuclear bomb.
Basically. And notably, he tells the tech guys, this tech isn't everything. They're like, no, we've scanned him. There's no problems. But then the tech doesn't pick up the glass knives.
Right.
And so there is like something to that material world, like, you know, hands-on, you know, interaction. And Enzo is even a guy that has like you know, while he's on the like mission of like everything's going crazy, he sees a pizza car crash, and he's like, make sure you give the driver the day off. And then the guy is like, oh, I thought I was supposed to see about that later. And he's like, no, you got to see about it now. You got to multitask. And like while he's running around with his knife, he's like, oh, YT reunited with her mother, that's good, I was meaning to check on that. Like he's got a million things going on in his head. He's just like wanting, and it says like details matter, relationships matter, and this like, but it, not in this way that he's like, oh, he's like, you know, this morally upstanding, like he's the head of the mafia, like
it's compassionate capitalism. Yeah, no,
he's got you know, a long list of bodies at the bottom of the river that he's ordered there, but nevertheless he is this guy. And he's also just, it's just fun to be in his head.
Personally decent. He is kind of what we're supposed to take away from it. He's the top of an evil system, but he is kind of personally decent. I think is kind of what we're supposed to take away from that sort of.
I would watch a Sopranos with Uncle Enzo.
Absolutely.
So he's supporting Hero in this like sort of final battle and kind of giving the gun support behind, while you know, Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong is giving this tech support and some of the robots and all that. And there is this like final fight basically, and it ends up, And all the characters are there, and the actual details of the firefight aren't like super important, but basically they're able to, Hiro and Juanita are able to get the what basically amounts to the counter spell. It's basically just the original thing that was used to do Babel, and they're able to speak it into the megaphone, and it's able to go out to a million people.
The Nam Shub of Enki.
Yeah, the Nam Shub of Enki. I couldn't remember it off the top of my head, but yeah, and it ends that, and then the battle happens again in the metaverse. Raven versus Hiro, and because he's going to release Snow Crash at this giant event for, you know, all the millions of hackers, and you have this funny moment. It's the last moment the Hiro shows up in the book. It's Hiro's final moment in the book, where this giant light thing explodes. It's the atomic bomb that Raven has always wanted to launch. That's going to fry all the hackers, the entire sort of digital class. Raven launches it, and Hiro at the last moment is able to hack into it and fix it. And when it reveals what should kill everyone, it says, "If this were a virus, you would be dead now. Fortunately, it's not. The metaverse is a dangerous place. How's your security? Call Hiro Protagonist Security Associates for a free initial consultation." And that's the last time Hiro shows up in the book. That's why YT is the character it ends on.
That's always bothered me is Raven dies at the end, I believe, doesn't he?
Yeah.
No,
he doesn't.
You're right. He's on the helicopter.
Yes. And he has that fight with Enzo, so he's just like kind of strung out on the ground.
That's right. His
tendon's been slashed.
Because they'd all be dead if Raven was dead.
That's what I was confused about. I was like, wait, doesn't he die? But no, you're right. Mm-hmm. Because he waves to YT and she flips him off.
Yeah. So, and that's kind of how it resolves. I mean, like, there's that final resolution with Fido coming in, like we talk about, and to protect YT, taking out L. Bob Reif. There's a giant explosion. And I mean, to say it's resolved is obviously there's going to be a lot of fallout, but that initial, and it does end on like a very, it's like a very like screeching to a halt ending on purpose.
That is very much how Neal Stephenson ends books. Yeah. Basically, I haven't read most of his later, like post mid 2000s stuff. So I don't know if he kept doing that, but everything up to that point, basically just ends. Often like in the middle of a scene, and he loves to do kind of like a cliffhanger ending as if there's going to be a postscript, and then there's just, which I have to say I kind of respect.
What's to be said,
and you do have a sense of a fundamental sea change in, you know, YT, in YT's relationship with her mother going forward, right? You know, she just hops in the car, doesn't even bother to hide her skateboard, right? She just tosses it in the back seat, and they're just like, home, yeah, let's go. And
she realized earlier in the book that her mom was about to be like infected or like killed by the virus, she thinks. So she just runs in and just smashes her mom's computer.
Yes.
In the middle of the house.
Mm-hmm.
So the cat's kind of out of the bag at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cat's kind of out of the bag. But yeah, at this time, they've accepted it. Yeah. And
notably, that's how it resolves. And Hiro presumably is going to have the cash flowing in, hopefully, for his sake. And
I love the, like, there's all this shit. I'm sorry to interrupt, but like,
no, that's what,
He's on Juanita's payroll, right, to sort of get to the bottom of this IRL. And he just keeps, he buys a top of the line motorcycle, you know.
He just goes
on a shopping spree, and he literally says, like, my favorite line in the book, "I'm on an expense account like you wouldn't believe." And not only that, like, when he goes and he buys the motorcycle, right, he's just showing off his hacking skills, like, oh yeah, you've got this motorcycle in on your previous shipment, oh, by the way, say hi to your niece for me, it's her birthday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, puts on sunglasses. Yeah,
It's when Hiro's,
and he's doing that to Juanita, which is funny because, like, obviously to call her a love interest would imply that there's more of a romance, but he's infatuated with her because of who she is. She's intelligent. They have a history. Doesn't go too much into it. At the end, there's implied they'll get back together. He's like, if we get out of here, will you be my girl? And she's like, naturally, you know, it's kind of
there is a neat part where, I say neat, but it's an interesting commentary, I think, on interpersonal relationships, and it's gendered, which I think is wrong, because I think this applies everywhere. Not it's not something like gender, it's not something like essential to any particular gender, but Juanita basically says that she didn't break up with Hiro because he didn't understand her. She broke up with him because he didn't understand himself.
Yeah.
Like, he was an idiot, basically. You know, like he's a nice guy and he was trying to understand her. The problem was that he was an idiot and needed to grow up, basically. And so I guess buying a cool motorcycle and saving the world is his version of growing.
I wrote down Hiro, you don't Hiro, come have sex with me. You keep studying the blade. Like that's basically it. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, gendered as it is in the prose, right? You know, there is an element here of, you know, you have to be a whole person in order to really interact with somebody on a comparable level, right? You know, you have to figure yourself out and, you know, figured out your niche in this world while still having the wherewithal to step outside of it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it is funny because when he first meets Juanita, he has this moment where he's like, oh, she's not like other girls. And then he realizes he's just kind of an asshole for having that thought. Like, he realizes, oh, like, that's just, no, women are actually just complicated, and I come from a background that forces women not to be.
Yes, yes. He describes it as, like, the sexism of guys who think they're too smart to be sexist.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, and I appreciated that. Actually, my favorite quote from the book comes from that section, and that's not the part about gender, but I thought it was just a really interesting way of writing, and it was, like, a way into Hiro's mind, and I don't know if it speaks to anything more broad, but I really like this quote. There's a certain type of small town that grows like a boil on the ass of every army base in the world, and a long series of such places Hiro protagonists with speed rays like a mutant hothouse orchid flourish under the glow of 1,000 buy and fly security spotlights, end quote. And I just wanted to make sure I read that before the end, because I like that idea that's also gives you another idea of how the prose is, but it also is just like a great insight into who Hiro is and a whole like generation of people that are homeless in a lot of ways, not homeless as in they don't have a place to sleep, homeless in the sense of like, they don't have any one place. They're just kind of in this corporatized world that they've just grown up in this hot house of literally Loglow, but they have found this like home as it is in the metaverse for better or worse. And whether or not that's a good thing, that's like the situation it's in. And in this book, that's kind of, it's maybe not idealized as in it's ideal that that we're in this situation, but given the situation we're in, it's like there is this like cool romantic idea of this person that this man without a country but as a hacker.
Yeah, you know, that sort of fundamental untetheredness to any specific place outside of a certain aesthetic, right?
Yeah,
that
you got
primes
it.
You for that primes you for operating in this grand crossroads.
Mm-hmm.
Do either of y'all have a quote, any quotes or any concepts or anything you want to share?
You said mine earlier, which I was glad because clearly clearly it resonated with other people. It was the one about like fleeing from the true America of atomic bombs and scoppings and so on. I really like that. There's another quote that is quite long, and so I won't read the whole thing, but it talks about how like the American male is this kind of like weirdly fixated, rapacious, focused on expanding. It always needs a new frontier. And so they just travel outward, destroying everything in their wake, building stuff, and then complaining that things aren't what they used to be, and then moving on to fuck up somewhere else. And it concludes by saying that like at some point hundreds of years in the future, millions of white men will arrive at the North Pole, and the like exuded heat will melt a hole in the ice, and they'll all just like fall to the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah. Josh, did you have any standouts besides the ones we've already shared?
There is one thing that I don't know what to do with that is not important, but it stands out nonetheless. There's a rapper from Japan, from Nippon, in this book Sushi K. And he headlines for Hiro's roommate, Vitaly Chernobyl. And it's just like the most insipid nonsense about how, oh, yeah, I'm rapping. I'm Japanese and I'm rapping. And it's just, I don't know. I don't really know what to do with it. Is it sort of a weird, like, funhouse mirror of American culture? Like, you know, That the mass culture of this rapacious manifest destiny that seeks to conquer the whole world is basically defined by nothing more than its ability to expand and to propagate, right? And there's just like nothing deeper than it. Like,
I think you hit the nail on the head there as part of it. I think it's also just like making fun of a poser.
Yeah.
And it's very much like in the 90s, it was a big thing to make fun of foreign rappers because they usually weren't very good yet. Now there's a lot of really good foreign rappers. I say foreign, you know, but rappers outside of America.
Shall we throw out a verse right quick?
At the time. What's that?
Shall I throw out a verse right quick just to
spit some fire? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'm Sushi K, and I'm here to say I like to rap in a different way. Let's go. Number one in every city, Sushi K rap has almost pretty. My special talking of remarkable words is not the stereotype bucktooth nerd. My hair is big as a galaxy because I attain greater technology.
Oh, hell yeah. I tweeted right after reading that scene, storming out of the club in a violent huff when the DJ looks confused after I ask him to play that new Sushi K fire.
Well, because in a sense, what I'm thinking about right now is the Life It Never Die, Women Are My Favorite Guy, you know, like 30 years on, you know, it's. We do have that kind of
it's the same joke.
Well, yeah, we do have that kind of like irony poisoned culture, right? Where we see this like not English that's kind of familiar, that kind of it's kind of reminiscent of it's the quirky foreigner factor, isn't it?
It's a bit racist, yes. And it is also bad. Translations of Japanese are funny, and they were very funny at the time. So,
and more common.
Yeah, and more common. So it is both like racist and that was the thing that you would encounter, especially in the early to mid 90s. But it is also, I think it does really stick out as a sore thumb, as a sore thumb, especially the kind of like broken English and how he's kind of just portrayed as like a big idiot. Like there's a real problem where I think like Asian people in particular are depicted in that very classical cyberpunk racist way of like, they're either emotionless robots.
Oh yeah. You know, like the deadpan hacker girl with the single like neon streak in her hair.
Exactly. Or they're buffoons, or they're like predators effectively, you know, the book I think does try to comment on this a bit. For instance, Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong, everything from them is always depicted in this very awkward, like bad translation into English, very like stereotypical errors. And yes. he kind of behaves as this like racist caricature, and then you actually meet him and he speaks perfect English and is just like a guy. He's just like a businessman. He's kind of the equivalent of like Colonel Sanders, where like he both is a real person and he's also a mascot, and there's like kind of like lives a double life. And I see what it's going for. I don't think it entirely pulls it off. I think maybe somebody who isn't Neal Stephenson might have done a better job.
Suffice to say. I will say, just as a personal note, as someone who in seventh grade tried to really get into battle rapping my friends, I love the starting anything with I'm insert name and I'm here to say. It's a classic. That's a still classic funny. Start. Always, that's always good. And salute to this book for making me remember that.
There's a certain charm in the just breathtakingly like blunt instruments that is a line like, I like to rap about sweetened romance, my fond ambition is of your pants.
it is funny, it's genuinely funny. It is also a bit racist.
May I say
something about the kind of where this book I think falls at a really interesting spot in the history of technology and technology culture. Mm-hmm. So like you guys are probably familiar with the California ideology, it's usually called, which is that kind of like Peter Thiel, anarcho-capitalist, techno-libertarian assumed ideology of Silicon Valley.
We're
kind of
going to invent our way out of,
Yeah, we're going to invent our way out of. We need the smart people to be in charge. The smart people deserve to get rich. We are, you know, God kings among men. It's that like Mencius mold bug. What we really need is the right people in charge. So that was one of the underlying ideologies of the internet, but it wasn't the original one and it wasn't the only one. I mentioned an article that I wrote called Nowhere Here earlier, which really talks about the origins of the concept of cyberspace. In the early 70s, there was a group called Resource One at UC Berkeley, and they created a project called Community Memory, which was basically arguably the first bulletin board system. So they put free terminals around Berkeley in coffee shops and record stores, where this was in 1973. So like a computer was not something that you would see in person. It was something that existed in the back room of like an IBM building. You know, it was not, there were no personal computers. Even like a mainframe with terminals was really rare to see. And so they just put free terminals in coffee shops, bookstores, etc., where you could log in, make a free account, and just post whatever you wanted. And people would post random stuff about, you know, hey, where's a good place to get pizza? They would post weird political stuff. They would post what's almost like digital performance theater. There were people who would write these kind of weird like pseudo religious texts. It was just random people just posting for the first time. Basically, the people in Resource One were Marxists primarily, like overt Marxists. And they believed, and this was the initial ideology of cyberspace, was of a non-hierarchical, communalist, open, unstructured space. They saw cyberspace as the great leveler, as something that wasn't owned by anyone. It was an opportunity to escape from capitalism. And they literally put it in these terms: we can escape from capitalism into a non-hierarchy, into a new world, basically. This was the new frontier where we could break out of our hierarchies. The challenge was in the 80s, it ran up against the kind of techno-libertarians. And for a long time, there was no visible difference between them because they both wanted to knock down the hierarchy that had grown up in the internet. So on the one hand, you kind of have that this hacker ideology, this like this vaguely egalitarian he's a gross guy, probably a sexual predator, but Richard Stallman was like a big figure at the time. And I actually don't know if he's alleged to be a sexual predator, so I apologize if I just did libel. He's not a great guy, suffice to say. But he was representative very much of this kind of everything should be free. The internet, it doesn't cost money to make copies of programs. Everything should be free. Everyone should have access to everything. On the one hand, and so he wanted to knock, and he and people like him and like Hero wanted to knock down these hierarchies, so that, you know, the internet could be free again. On the other hand, you have the kind of ANCAP people who want to knock down the hierarchies so that they can build a new hierarchy with the smart people in charge. And ultimately, and I think what you kind of see in this book is the unresolved tension between those two things. Because like, what's the problem? The problem is that L. Bob Reif is in charge and not people like Hero and Juanita. And like I kind of alluded to at the beginning, the issue is Snow Crash and books like it, and that this kind of like hybrid ideology has no real answer to what happens when you put the smart people in charge and they're just as corrupt and they're just as capitalist, because there's no real material critique inherent in Snow Crash, right? There's a hierarchical critique, there's a bureaucratic critique, but there's no idea of it's very much like everyone should have the opportunity to be a rugged individualist. Basically, yes. And it's that's not incompatible with capitalism, and I think we see that in your Elon Musk's, your Peter Thiel's, and I think you also see it in Stevens's later career of working with Jeff Bezos and working with like Peter Thiel type, you know, in involved companies. Like someone like Neal Stephenson, I think his heart is in the right place, but he doesn't have a materialist critique of anything. He has a bureaucratic critique, and he probably looks, you know, if his, again, his issue with someone like Elon Musk is not that he's a billionaire who shouldn't control stuff. It's that he sucks. Yeah. And, you know,
he's not good at it. Yeah.
He's not good at it. So once you get an evil smart guy, there's really no answer from this type of cyberpunk. And I think we're kind of living to this day in a lot of the fallout of that is a lot of that egalitarian spirit of the internet was assumed by a lot of people to still be around. And then suddenly it went away, you know, and it's like, well, fuck, you know, we got rid of IBM, but now we have Google and Facebook. And is that any better? I'd say it's worse because they're fucking better at it. You know, at least IBM and L. Bob Reif were kind of hapless. So it's I think this book, you know, to the extent that it doesn't age well, it's the racism and the sexism and a bit, you know, there's it tries to not assume a white male point of view. And much like Stevenson observing, it's the kind of sexism that, you know, of sexists who think they're too smart to be sexist. This is the kind of neoliberalism of someone who thinks that they're too smart to be neoliberal, kind
Absolutely.
Of. And I really wanted it to work. I would love if, you know, you could, if just opening up the internet and giving everyone access was the answer. I think you need a little bit more than that to solve
Absolutely.
The problem. So
yes,
two things I'll say. The first, Richard Stallman resigned from MIT because he defended Jeffrey Epstein publicly. And said that said some pretty bad stuff I won't repeat.
Yes.
Oh yeah, he's a huge misogynist too. He's posted like really nasty shit about you know, women are inferior.
So you didn't do libel, don't worry.
Yeah, second, no, it's quite rancid, yeah.
Second, to your point, which absolutely 100% agree. I'll also say that concept of we'll have capitalism, but we'll all be individual movers and we'll all be free and we'll all be whatever. And it sounds a whole lot like we're just doing the tech version of the yeoman farmer. We're doing.
Yeah, exactly.
We're doing a Thomas Jefferson's vision of the United States of like a bunch of little plots of land with smokestacks going up, and a guy who is you know, very smart and hardworking, and he tills the fields and he's an intellectual and whatever, and he's gonna go get it, and no man dominates him.
But the thing about Thomas Jefferson is that where there is a Thomas Jefferson, there has to be a Sally Hemings.
Exactly. My point is, who is tilling the fields of the yeoman farmer? Yes. Right. And who is mining the cobalt and the lithium for the yeoman hacker, you know, who is making the parts, and who is indeed doing the work that YT's mom does of like writing the bullshit code. And in this world, in the world of Snow Crash, that code is actually bullshit. But guess what? There is a lot of bullshit code that feels like bullshit to write that actually does have to get written every single day. There is a lot of work that does have to get done that is somewhat drudgery. There is, you know, stuff that happens day to day that workers carry out, that there is no shame in the fact that the workers carry that out. It is necessary to the functioning of society. So the concept of like the individuals who conquer the world, and it's okay and it's equal and it's egalitarian because we can all be the individuals who conquer the world, don't realize that is predisposed, that it is on top of the 99% of whether you want to say they're failures because they weren't good enough, or whether they were good enough and they didn't get there, whatever you want to call it. It is still hierarchy. It is still domination. And it is still not the world that we need to strive for.
And the other thing is, if you have contempt for the people in the suburbs, if you see them as just like grist for the mill of the smart people, that's a complete absence of solidarity.
Yes.
You know, you shouldn't have contempt for you know, the dumb suburb people, dumb and annoying though they may be, they're the ones that you can have solidarity with, not David, not, you know, Mr. Lee, and unfortunately, sorry, not Uncle Enzo.
Uncle Enzo can be a class traitor.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, class-wise, that's, you know, class-wise, unfortunately, it's
no,
the,
you're right.
You know, as we said in The President Is Missing, right? It's the point.
He's a small business owner. What do you want from the guy?
Yeah.
It's the point where the president meets up with the Prime Minister of Israel and the Chancellor of Germany, right? You know, it's Hiro who helped build the internet meeting with the, you know, the president of the mafia and, you know, Mr. Lee, you know, the CEO of Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong, right? It's these big movers and shakers. And who, I mean, it's especially galling because, like, Stevenson flies so close to the point here, right? We said earlier, you know, he says that, 90% of humanity is priced out of the metaverse. You know, he says straight up, class isn't income. It's where you stand in a web of social relations. And he doesn't quite make the connection of, okay, and therefore there needs to be solidarity among this exploited working class, right? You know, because the only community in this book is for the sake of its own propagation, right? For to silo yourself off in increasingly tiny, burbclaves and subcultures and criminal enterprises, you know, bound solely by oath. You know,
unionize the couriers.
Yeah, well,
there
we go.
That's what it comes down to.
There we go. Like, you know, the best you can aspire to is just to pull down a helicopter with the combined power of your magnetic harpoons.
There's a lot more Marxist cyberpunk authors now. And there were a few early on too, but one person who I think was active around the same time as this and remains active today, certainly not immune to critique, but I will say, of the various early central cyberpunk figures, Bruce Sterling actually understands Marxism to a great degree. I don't always agree with it with his politics. In fact, I often disagree, but he actually is, I think, if you're going to look at like Stevenson, Gibson, and Sterling, in a lot of ways are like the big figures of like late 80s, early 90s cyberpunk. I think Sterling comes the closest to getting it, which is funny because his books are far and away the wackiest.
Yeah. So maybe we should talk about Schizomatrix or Islands in the Net before too long. That would be fun. Those are both Bruce Sterling, right?
Yes.
I'm thinking of the right guy,
they,
right?
They are. Yeah.
I'm making sure I'm remembering correctly. It's been a minute. But yeah, he actually
wrote a few years ago kind of his own version of Homage to Catalonia. He wrote a book about the Spanish Civil War that I haven't read. It's called A Pirate Utopia.
Why do you know? Huh. Worth looking into. Well, we've talked about a lot. And the funny thing is we could talk about more, but you know, this book is a lot. I recommend people read this book if you've got, you know, the time and you're interested. It's fun. It's a lot of fun. It's easy to read. For all my issues with it, I still really like it a lot. I still really appreciate it. There's like concepts
in it. It's a
world
that I wish we could, you know, travel about in, you know.
Yeah, there's concepts that are going to rattle around in my head for a while from this book too, I think. Like,
yeah,
just
the Burbclave captures some, like that idea, yeah. it captures something that I think nobody else is quite, nobody, he was on the right wavelength, if nothing else, like really
no
captured
doubt.
Something that was coming.
Mm. No doubt. So yeah, I think that this book is, you know, it's very interesting. It bears thinking about, and it bears thinking about our own future with whatever metaverse or is coming, or, you know, I hear Legs is coming soon in the metaverse. Yeah. Don't know about that. Whether it be VR, or, you know, more likely be more insidious versions on social media and through the commodification of art and beauty online and turning it into a thing that is, you know, run by the rentier class. I mean, the news just broke about like what Unity Game Engine is doing and some of that. You can look into that if you're interested. But this and with AI and these different things like that, that is a struggle that exists and will continue to exist. And there are a lot of L. Bob Ripes in the world. And unfortunately, it's not going to be as simple as pulling down their helicopters to just as a single act to get it to change. But I do believe that with, you know, across the world, this kind of solidarity, not just between the cool movers and shakers, but between the peoples in the burbclaves and the hackers and the immigrants on the raft, we can bring down the Elbob rights, and we can bring about some kind of better world, some kind of better future. But
solidarity
then,
with the raft, solidarity with the Burb Clave, critical support for Uncle Enzo.
Critical support for Uncle Enzo. Yeah, that's exactly right. Kurt, I really appreciate you coming on. Do you have anything to plug?
I, as was mentioned at the beginning, I'm the editor in chief of Blood Knife Magazine. We are a digital magazine about science fiction, fantasy, horror, and capitalism. Usually more science fiction and horror than fantasy, but we do indulge in that as well. We publish a few articles each month, and every other month we put out a themed to one degree or another issue. You can find us at bloodknife.com. Our annual State of Cyberpunk issue is about to come out. We have some really interesting articles in there, taking a look at different kind of nooks and crannies of the current cyberpunk/cyberspace scene. I have a short review of Cory Doctorow's new book, The Internet Con, which kind of puts forth a blueprint for how to unfuck the internet. And I think it gets something, much like this book, I think it gets some things right and some things kind of wrong in a lot of the same ways, actually. If you subscribe, you can get early access to articles. And of course, we appreciate the support. Every cent that we get goes towards either a little bit goes towards, you know, paying for the website, but most of it, over the overwhelming majority, goes towards paying our authors and artists. And that is our number one priority, is to publish high quality stuff and to pay fairly. And so, like I said, that's at bloodknife.com and patreon.com/bloodknife.
I will plug this. Jacob introduced me to it with the article that y'all put out recently about deindustrialized American town.
2 years ago now, right?
Yes.
Architecture of Woe is what you're talking
Architecture
about.
Architecture of Woe, yes.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah, you wrote that.
I did, yes.
Yeah, deindustrialized American town as Lovecraftian entity, and the bleak beauty therein. It's a really remarkable piece. I highly recommend y'all look into it.
We talked about it extensively at the dinner where we officially decided to start a podcast. So
nice.
Yeah. Not to embarrass you, but we appreciate that piece a lot.
Yes. Never embarrassed. And I've said it before and I will say it again. You know, the number one thing, I did a whole episode recently with the podcast Wet Wired, which is another leftist podcast, kind of talking about culture and capital and all that great stuff. And we talked about the kind of fucked state of the internet and publishing. And one of the things that I said that I will reiterate is the number one thing that I want to achieve is to encourage people to A, make stuff of their own, and B, fucking get paid for it, because it's hard work writing, podcasting, making this stuff. People who do it should be able to get paid. And the only way that we're going to get back to that and to make the internet not shit is for, you know, people like us to make stuff. So the highest compliment I can receive is that somebody saw something that we did and was like, I can do that too, and then went off and did it. Even if they're like, this Blood Knife shit sucks, I can do way better. That's fine. I'll still take credit for that.
Oh, man. Well, yeah, absolutely agree and absolutely appreciate it. Well, folks, thank you for listening. And Joss, do you have any thoughts on a sign-off for this one?
As the great visionary Neil Breen once said, we will all live in a digital metaverse, digital tribes.
Have a good one, y'all.